Well, first, let me say thank you to Gordy. That was lovely and a lovely introduction, and I feel so gratified to have been redeemed in your estimation through the work that I have done since I came to Boston. I may rebut just a little bit, though, as we move forward. So I wanted to comment first on the title of the presentation. So I titled my talk, Promises and the Promise of Organizations Research for Quality Improvement in Public Health, because I wanted to do two things today. Of course, I want to talk about promises and its impressive accomplishments, but I also want to discuss the potential of organizations research for improving public health and quality more generally, because I believe that my receiving the Donna Beadian Award today reflects in part that promise. This is what I'm going to do. If you'll indulge me, a few words of thanks, because I never have the opportunity to do that. And then I want to also take a minute to thank some important people in my life. Then reflect on the relationship for the Donna Beadian Award. I'll spend most of my time talking about the Promises Project, its background and results, and then reflect on some of the lessons that I learned from this project. So to begin with thanks. So first, I want to acknowledge my most important mentors along the way. And the first one I do have to talk about is Alan and Tobin. So he remains a dear colleague, a friend, and an advisor, and I should say a strong advocate as well. Alan took a real risk by hiring me away from a healthcare magazine when I told him that I was interested in pursuing a higher degree to study the healthcare industry. And in the early 1990s, Gordy, you may not know this, but he and I developed the first course on quality management in healthcare in a business school. We did it while we were at Stanford, and it was based on the ideas of people like Deming and Duran and Donna Beadian, as well as others. But Alan really showed me a couple of things by his example. He taught me to be a continuous learner, and he taught me the importance of organizations' response to market incentives and market forces. He always felt it was really important to get out into the organizations to understand what they were doing in response to the kinds of incentives that were created, so he's never too far away from what was going on the ground. The second most important mentor for me was Alan Garber. He's now provost at Harvard. But he invited me while we were still at Stanford to co-found and build together with him a Center for Health Policy. And through his partnership, Alan taught me to value interdisciplinary research that was both rigorous and relevant. And lastly, Amy Edmondson, who was my dissertation chair at Harvard, she inspired me with her own research and showed me that getting close to a phenomenon and studying it from multiple perspectives can really reveal insights beyond just crunching numbers. So all of those lessons that I took from my advisors, I hope you'll see here today. There are plenty of others to thank, the institutions that supported me, Princeton, Stanford, and Harvard, the funding agencies who have allowed me to do what I consider to be meaningful work, AHRQ, VA, foundations like Commonwealth, California Healthcare Foundation, RWJ, et cetera, and then the multitude of professors, students, collaborators, including my colleagues who are here today, with whom I've had the privilege to work and to learn, and then my family. I thought my husband was going to make it, but he has a conflict. But I did want to acknowledge that they have put up with a tremendous amount of long days and nights to allow me to do the work. Okay. So I started by saying that I wanted to reflect on the award and its implications for the ability of organizations' research to impact quality improvement in public health. And so I couldn't help but notice when I looked at the Donna Beadian Award and the list of previous Donna Beadian Award winners, who are, you know, clearly an incredible set of acclaimed and passionate people whose company I am grateful and honored to join, but they're mostly physicians and definitely not MBA, PhD, organizational research scholars. So I reflected on that. I asked myself, what does receiving this award mean then? So my answer is that I think receiving this award acknowledges the potential for healthcare management, and more specifically for research focused on healthcare organizations, leadership, and innovation of the sort that I do, has the opportunity to contribute to public health. So I wanted to start with one of the key lessons from Dr. Donna Beadian. His work suggests that we need to examine healthcare quality as a system that structures and processes lead to quality outcomes. And this has been the dominant paradigm for thinking about healthcare quality since he introduced it in 1966. But we're in 2013 now, and we face urgent requirements to improve the healthcare system and to quote-unquote bend the cost curve by spreading innovations that work and by doing it quickly. So the 2010 Donna Beattie Award winner, her name was Mai Pham, she likes to say, we can't wait around to demonstrate that an intervention is effective and wait for the 17 years that it typically takes organizations to adopt it. We need to squeeze every ounce of information out of an evaluation to affect change, and we need to do it now. So this is where I think that organizations' research can really contribute. By using mixed methods to study organizational structures and processes up close, organization researchers aim to develop a deeper understanding about the hows and whys of how those structures and processes affect outcomes. And it's this deeper insight that makes spreading change more quickly, more feasible. So PROMISE is an example of how organizations' research contributes to successful spread, so I'm going to use it as a case study today. First, a little bit of background, which I probably don't need to share among this group. I assume that most of you know the statistics that suggest preventing medical errors could account for 98,000 deaths per year, somewhat less by some measures, considerably more by others. Associated costs amount to $29 billion per year. And considering CDC data for leading causes of death in the U.S. Would attribute preventable medical errors as the sixth leading cause of death. So by any measure, this suggests that preventable medical errors are an important public health outcome. Less acknowledged, though, are medical errors in ambulatory settings, as Gordy was saying. So most efforts since the 1999 Institute of Medicine reports have focused on inpatient settings, despite the fact that a majority of care is delivered in the outpatient arena. Research, including new research by PROMISE's investigators, suggests that outpatient processes are also quite error-prone. And because there's so little focus on patient safety and ambulatory care, these settings lack safeguards and redundancies that are now being built into inpatient systems. And as a result, the outpatient errors are less likely to be caught and addressed before they cause harm. And risk management and oversight is also less well developed in ambulatory care. So here's one example that I identified that was identified as part of an analysis of closed claims. So here you have a 28-year-old who comes in to his physician with a problem. The physical exam reveals nothing, but a test does come back positive. And then over 15 visits and 2 years, there's no follow-up. But 28 months later, a specialist finds cancer in this patient. So unfortunately, errors like these are not uncommon in outpatient settings. They reveal multiple breakdowns in multiple processes across multiple providers. And as in inpatient settings, the problems can be attributed to systems and not to people. Later, Harry's going to describe some of the findings from our chart reviews based on PROMISE's practices. But for now, I'll simply say that paid malpractice claims involving outpatient events are quite common. And we need to do something about it. And that's really the underlying motivation for the PROMISE's project. But I borrowed this slide from other presentations that have been done. There were multiple motivations. We wanted to extend the Harvard malpractice study to ambulatory settings. We wanted to help to overcome a policy stalemate, what to do about tort reform in particular. There was recognition that a major problem driving malpractice is actually malpractice, so we wanted to focus on the things that were leading to malpractice, which was quite different from the other proposals that were funded by ARC. And we wanted to understand in ways that would allow us to address the error-prone processes. We recognized that that outpatient problems were not just inpatient problems slowed down. So Gordy described the 3+1 areas, so I won't describe them again. But what I will do is to try and focus you in on some of the things that I thought were really special about the Promises Project. So in honor of Dr. Don Abedian, for whom the award was named, I thought I would use his famous structure process outcome model to explain some of those whys and hows that I think we're learning from the Promises Project. So first is what I'll call the theory of organizations underlying the Promises Project. So we structured the organization of the project in what I think is a pretty unique and compelling way. We had four different work groups and a core group. There was overlapping and redundant participation that allowed for people to work together. We established processes that enabled people to work together well. There was regular communication across all of the groups. There was also what I describe as a personal connection. There were efforts to make sure that people really knew each other as people, that we stopped and we said thank you to whatever was going on and acknowledged the things that were important at the beginning of every single meeting. And there were opportunities to reflect amongst ourselves on what went right and what we could do better. And that those structures and processes led to an important organizational outcome. We were all informed, we were motivated, we were continually learning from each other, and we were cross-checking the investigation against the improvement work as it went on. I also inferred from Promises a theory of change, which we described more or less explicitly as we went along. But why did we design the intervention the way that we did is something I wanted to codify here. So structurally, we designed it as a randomized control trial, basically. But there were 16 demonstration or intervention sites, all of whom had volunteered. Volunteering, I think, was important because it demonstrated their interest in working with us to address error-prone processes. They were also of approximately similar size so that they had opportunities to learn from each other. And there was programmatic support by an important agency, so they felt like what they were doing was important. There were processes that were established early on. We defined specific improvement targets. There was the 3+1, there were enough targets to capture things that were important for most practices, but not so many as to prevent learning across the practices. We use primarily coaching. I think, and I'll talk more about this a little bit, and then Nicholas and Judy will do so as well, but I really think the coaching was the magic sauce here. But initially, we assumed that coaching would be helpful because we expected that practices would be at different starting places and would be interested in working at different things, and the coaches could work with them. And then there was this feedback component, feedback, benchmarking, and evaluation, which was from the get-go designed to try to motivate and direct practices by providing the information back to them. And that these structures and processes were intended to lead to outcomes, the improvement in the 3+1 targeted areas, but also directly and through spread to ultimately improve patient safety and to reduce malpractice suits. So that is the theory underlying the project. Because I'm the evaluation co-lead, I wanted to say a little bit more about the principles underlying the evaluation strategy. First, by combining the surveys of administrators and practice staff and patients with chart review and with qualitative data, we wanted to combine multiple perspectives for understanding why and how these the malpractice was occurring in ambulatory settings. The idea that sometimes readying people for change takes reinforcement, so you need to hear from multiple people. We thought that multiple perspectives would help us get beyond comments like, but those problems don't happen here. Sometimes they really need to see it for themselves. Second, we wanted to create a seamless integration of the evaluation and the improvement components of the project. This meant that we wanted them to be mutually supportive, that the evaluation would support the improvement effort and the improvement effort would provide data for the evaluation, and that these could work together very helpfully in an action research oriented mode. So We knew that the overlap in participation across the work groups would promote the relevance of the evaluation and the rigor of the improvement intervention. For example, the improvement and dissemination work groups work together to with the evaluation team to provide information to develop a survey that we knew would address those 3+1 areas in a way that the improvement advisors could take the information back to the practices and use it to motivate their improvement. So here is a roadmap. This is we could call it the Bible, but I call it the roadmap because that's the name that we gave it initially. And this is what we did with regard to evaluation. You can see that it's multi-pronged, lays out each component of the evaluation, their goals, the tools that we use, the methods, the sites where the evaluation applied. So, for example, the staff and patient surveys we did in both the demonstration and the control sites, but the chart reviews we did just in the demonstration sites. The roadmap also says which work groups owned which evaluation component, et cetera. So I'm going to start with some of the results from the administrator and provider surveys. We surveyed all staff and all the practices, both demonstration and controls, and these results come from the baseline survey. We just came out of the field with the post-test, and we're analyzing those results, so I can't share them. I can't share those yet. But according to staff, so 96% of the respondents said good things about medication management. Their lists are being updated during visits most of the time. But more problems with regard to referral and test result management. So about 30% of the respondents complained about being able to exchange information, being able to track their consultation notes, and being able to reliably follow up when consultation notes weren't received. With regard to test results, 13% of the respondents said that their office had problems getting data that they needed from outside labs, and about 50% of them said that patients on high-risk meds who needed monitoring were always getting it, meaning about half of them weren't getting it. We also learned about variation across different disciplines, which were interesting. You can see here each discipline in comparison to the average and to each other along these scales. And what you see on the left, with regard to referral and test result management, the practitioners, the physicians, the PAs, the nurse practitioners, had a much more negative perception of referral management and test result management than the other players. Perhaps because it's their necks on the line for these things, or perhaps because they're more, they interact more with these processes. But if you look at the other extreme with regard to teamwork, it's actually the physicians and the PAs and nurse practitioners that are above average with respect to their perceptions of teamwork. And similarly, although only a trend towards significance, we get a laugh at the fact that the managers had the most positive perceptions of their own practice leadership. So we also looked at variation across practices, and this is an example with regard to patient communication and the impact on malpractice concerns. So this shows by practice the percent of respondents who are at least moderately concerned that the way their office communicated with patients put them at risk of a malpractice suit. You can see there's a big range. From the perspective of the improvement work, that was a good thing because you could use that to motivate people on the right that they really had an opportunity to change. So relative to both a median benchmark and an 80th percentile benchmark, the ones on the far right had an awfully long way to go. I wanted to show a little bit of the feedback that we actually gave to practices. So each practice for each survey got feedback that looked a little bit like this. So for each item, we showed them their results plus the median plus the 80th percentile benchmark. So you can see, for example, with regard to that first question, they aren't investing enough resources to improve the quality of care in this office. The specific practice had about 40% of what we call a negative response, the orange and the red, and about 30% more as neutral, so 70% altogether, compared to the median where it was 50% altogether neutral or negative responses, and to the 80th percentile, just 15% neutral and negative responses. So this kind of feedback was very powerful in helping direct the practices about where to go. So now I want to show some results from the patient survey. And in each demonstration and control practice, we surveyed 150 patients. And these are some of those results. So in general, patients viewed practices even more positively than the practice staff. So we had to do a little bit of work to explain to practices that we weren't surprised by this result, that patients often give their providers the benefit of the doubt unless there is something egregiously wrong. And so it's typically a small percentage who see those things. But patients did identify problems in some important respects. So, for example, only about 30% of patients said that their providers always ask them for their ideas about managing their health, the communication item. 35% strongly disagreed that their provider cared more about holding down costs than doing what's needed for health, suggesting a real lack of trust among a substantial minority of patients. For patients who use specialists, only about half said their PCP always talked about care they'd received outside the primary care provider's office. We'd like to see that a lot more. Then with regard to the quality of the primary care provider, about 10% of patients said that they'd had a negative experience with their provider or the provider's office. And of these, about 20% had considered leaving the practice as a result. So this kind of question really got the attention of the providers in these practices because it suggested that there was a potential for them to lose money. But somewhat to our surprise, the open-ended comments to the patient survey were the ones that really got the practice's attention. So we asked in the survey, is there anything else you'd like to add? And a third of the patients actually responded to the question. And one of our interns diligently analyzed more than 500 comments and then coded them by theme. So you see the themes here. And as you can see, there were lots of themes. The communication with physicians was the most common among them. And comments were both positive and negative. And very often the comments were both positive and negative at the same time, trying to sort of ease the comments. But we also grouped some of the categories of comments into larger categories. For example, we grouped these four: test result management, referral management, medication management, and medical records and patient history into a larger category that we called medical information management. And I wanted to share some of the comments in this category to give you a sense of them. So a couple of things to notice here. So first, these comments highlight some of the issues that were the same as the issues that the staff recognized. So, for example, they should follow through on referrals when they say they're going to send them. Well, the staff recognize that, and the patients are confirming. They provide reasonable suggestions. On the upper right, they should have taken blood work before my exam so that we could have discussed the results at our visit. Absolutely true. And they offer, in some cases, a human dimension that's not available through the staff survey or through the multiple choice patient survey questions. So when I need other care, it seems like I'm on my own. This patient is, you know, saying that they're feeling abandoned by their practice. And that kind of verbatim comment when you saw it come across your desk often did inspire the practices. So these comments had powerful impacts, particularly in combination with the staff surveys and the patient surveys that they reinforced. It's a little like this 1-2 punch. If my staff say it, maybe they're just complaining, but if the patients say it too, that it's more likely that that it's true and I really need to do something about it. So the last piece of the evaluation that I wanted to share comes from the qualitative data. So we collected qualitative data from multiple sources all the way along as the intervention was proceeding, feedback from webinars and from face-to-face meetings, and exit interviews at the end of the project. The qualitative analysis is still ongoing. It's probably going to be the last work that we complete, but I wanted to give you a sense of where we're headed with this. So we're using the qualitative data to ask a couple of questions. First, what differentiated the high-performing and the low-performing practices? So it's clear that not all of the practices will succeed, and knowing whether the practices overall or the promises overall had an impact is less interesting, less helpful as a result than actually knowing why the high-performing practices perform well. So based on some preliminary analysis, one of the hypotheses that we're pursuing is whether high-performing practices took on more divergent projects and whether they approached them differently than the lower-performing practices. And by divergent, what I mean is projects that diverge in any way from the status quo. For example, there were some projects that require a different way of engaging with their referral partners. And we noticed that when practices reached outside their walls to sit down with those referral partners to design ways of changing their practices, that those were often more successful. So we're looking at this more systematically to see if we can identify a pattern here. And the second way that we're using the qualitative data is to help us understand what about the intervention was effective for practices. So here we expect that that theory of change that I showed you initially will be upheld, but we're hoping to glean some additional insight about the mechanisms underlying the positive effect of these structures and practices. All right. So, for example, from the excerpt interviews, the practice leaders we heard from said things like this. Before Promises, it was less organized in terms of how we handle challenges that we see in primary care practice. We didn't have any good mechanisms in place. So practices didn't have a process for identifying safety hazards, for identifying them in a systematic way. We also heard we're able to conquer things that we didn't even know existed. Believe it or not, we had close to 50,000 open loops, so that we had to develop a system in order to resolve them. They feel like they're at 100%. So practices needed to know what they didn't know. So through our baseline evaluations that motivated them to look and help them choose where to begin to look, and through the studying part of the plan, do, study, act cycle that Nicholas and Judy introduced with them, we imposed a discipline that allowed practices to quantify the magnitude of their problem, often for the first time. And then through small tests of change, they were able to identify open loops and to close them systematically. So that's part of the special sauce that I see going on. So from the perspective of organizations and management research, there are several lessons that I'm going to conclude with that I think we can take away from Promises. First, about action research, the type that marries improvement and evaluation in a seamless way, I think can accomplish real-world improvement and can increase the likelihood of spreading intervention by explaining how and why it works. A clearer understanding about the path and its rationale is necessary for this new setting and helpful for accomplishing this goal. So second, the 3+1. I think it was a really highly effective mantra. So the rationale for focusing on three high-risk areas plus culture and communication, it was clear, it was evidence-based, and it was often repeated, so practices knew what it was. But the targets were also sufficiently few that practices could share their learning, but enough so that they could broadly allow flexibility. And they enabled the evaluation team to delve deeply into each area. Am I done? I'm getting there. I just have a couple more comments. So lastly, about coaching, and I know we're going to hear about it from Judy and Nicholas, but we expected it would be helpful, and it was, but I don't think we fully appreciated the importance of it. I like to say that the coaches helped the practices learn how to fish. By making themselves available on a regular basis, the coaches were able to provide a just-in-time teaching about the things that the practices needed to know when they were ready to put them to work, and it proved highly effective. And the coaches helped practices overcome the hurdles that might have otherwise otherwise thwarted them. By unsticking the practices, when they got stuck, the coaches helped them kind of get to the end goal to show them that it could be done, and I think that that was tremendously important. Last thing I wanted to do is to say that I started by thanking the people who've made a real impact on my life and my research, and I have this whole new crowd of collaborators to add, so I wanted to thank the Promises team for including me in this project and for the special recognition today.
So you're going to meet the improvement advisors, and they're going to make the next presentation, and then we're going to show you some of the stuff from the chart reviews. Again, I don't think we ever used to define Promises as proactive reduction of outpatient malpractice, improving safety, efficiency, and satisfaction. We've done the intervention. It's a 15-month intervention. It finished last April. And again, now we're just actually in the no-cost extension phase where we're trying to collect the last bits of data, and then we're going to find out whether we really made a difference, although I think you're going to hear about ways we feel like we already have. A couple of questions for Sarah, and then we'll move on to the next two speakers.
I don't know if I might have missed this. Were these charts electronic or were they handwritten?
Charts?
You
want to answer? We went to the practices, and we used whatever charts the practices had. For the most part, they were...
mostly electronic.
Yeah, they were...
There was one on paper, so we had 15 electronic, one paper, and they became electronic in the course of the project. One of our criteria was we didn't want to pick a practice that was going to transition in the middle because we thought that was too chaotic, but you could see we didn't even succeed there.
Yeah. Harry is going to present about the chart review, so I didn't spend time talking about that.
How were the survey questions developed in
CAPS? That is a great question. So what I thought was important about the way that we developed the survey questions was that we worked with the improvement advisors to hear from them what was important, and we worked with the dissemination group so they could say, you know, what's going to help us be able to spread this work. So we took that into account initially. But we looked at lots of existing surveys about culture surveys and about these high-risk areas. And we tried to take the best of, especially whole sets of questions where we could. But we also wanted a framework that created a structure within this survey itself so that it would work for us and for this group. So we started with the three high-risk domains and asked questions about those areas, and then we went through different aspects of culture and communication that we thought were important and relevant and that first providers and then patients could speak to. And we did...
Validated tools, you might mention.
Right, yes. So we took a variety of validated tools in looking at those, but we then went through a cognitive interviewing process, so we asked patients to... I mean, you're probably familiar with that. We asked patients to review it. We had them speak to us about what they thought the items meant to make sure that they were understanding them in the ways that we did. So we didn't have guarantee of reliability and validity before we went out, except that we felt fairly secure because we were taking a lot of it from prior validated work. And as it turned out, the survey actually turned out to be quite reliable. Almost all the dimensions met the criteria, except the ones that had very few items in the domains, and we were very fortunate in that regard.
And are the surveys actually public or available?
Happy to make them available.
Yes, we're posting them online as we speak, yes.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the patients who saw frequently saw specialists were less happy with their primary care doctor's coordination with care. Isn't that understandable? Maybe the primary care doctor is not the person who should be coordinating with care for
I think that that's probably yes, absolutely. In the other work that I'm doing to survey patients about it, they tell us that often. But what we found is that patients perceive patients get angry enough about their about the extent to which their care is being coordinated by their primary care office that they're willing. That a lot of them are willing to leave the office in search of another. So they actually, enough of them view the role of the primary care provider as important to be doing that to suggest that they're willing to go as a result.
And I hate to add, the judge and juries are also weighing in on this. And they're saying the primary care doctors do have a responsibility, and the physicians and the practices will push back against this. So this is a very contested area and confusion, and obviously there has to be some clear delineation of responsibility. Otherwise, not only will patients feel abandoned, balls are going to fall through the cracks. Yeah. I'm going to take one last question, this lady in the back. And
you mentioned the theory of change earlier. Was that used in your framework work that you have used for your survey? And if yes, which theory of change have you used?
Well, so I was thinking about theory of change generically and trying to define a theory of change that I inferred from all of the work that we've done. So it goes beyond, that theory of change went beyond just the evaluation component of the project to include the whole project. Why do we think the Promises project works? Because of the way it was structured and organized, and because of all the processes that we undertook to coach and to improve and to focus on the defined targets, to provide the feedback. And I think that it's the combination of those structural and process features of the program that actually led to the